So let's see. The last two lectures, they were iJulia on hands sessions. We've learned a number of things. I want to summarize them. So first, we've learned how to build 2n times 2n matrices for the Hamiltonian, for the translation operator, and for the spin flip operator. The Hamiltonian was the Ising model Hamiltonian. And the translation operator was that one that was shifting sides on the circle. And the spin flip operator was one that was flipping all the spins and was just the product of sigma z's. And for each of these, we've been able to build this huge matrix, 2n times 2n. Okay? That's one thing we've seen how to do. And then we've also learned how to simultaneously diagonalize these three matrices. These three matrices, Hamiltonian, translation operator, and spin flip operator, they commute. And so they can be diagonalized simultaneously. We can find a basis of eigenvectors that are eigenvectors of the three of them at the same time. And so here what I wrote were the eigenvalues by H, right? So the energies. The energies are going to be real numbers. The eigenvalues by the translation operator, these are complex faces. And this angle is going to be our momentum, the momentum attached to this eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. And finally, the spin flip is going to give us some either plus or minus 1, which is minus 1 to the parity of the state. So the parity will be 0 or 1. Okay. So every eigenstate of the Hamiltonian can be characterized by its energy, but also momentum and parity. Okay. Very good. And then what did we do with that? Well, we specialized to the case where the magnetic field H was equal to 1. That's the critical magnetic field, transverse magnetic field for the Ising model. And at that point, we know that the Hamiltonian is actually quantum critical, meaning that it's long distance behavior is described by some conformal field theory. And what we did is we tried to understand what conformal field theory we had by trying to extract some of the properties, some of the parameters that characterize this CFT, known as conformal data. Okay? Pieces of data which are universal, which only depend on the universality class of the quantum phase transition. And specifically, we looked at extracting scaling dimensions and conformal spins. Probably you are more familiar with phase transition being characterized by critical exponents. So it turns out that these critical exponents are a function of this scaling dimension. Okay, I'm not going to write explicitly the relations, but you can search for them in the literature. So if we know, for instance, the scaling dimensions, then we know the critical exponents of the phase transition. Very good. So how did we extract this conformal data? Well, we use two expressions that relate the energy and momenta on the spin chain with the scaling dimensions and the conformal spins of the CFT. Okay? So again, as I said the other day, this thing here is universal data. And this thing here is just numerical output that you obtain from diagonalizing these matrices that you know how to build. And then what we saw is that, roughly speaking, we could extract scaling dimensions and conformal spins organized by parity. So for p equal to 0, we had some that the energies and momenta corresponded to scaling dimensions and conformal spins, where we could see the identity operator here from the CFT, or the scaling dimension and conformal spin of the identity operator, some energy density. There was some structure. The eigenvalues, these eigenvalues, energy and momentum, appear with some structure. And from there, we could read the expected properties of the CFT. Okay? We did this for parity 0. We did this for parity 1. And there, for parity 1, we had the spin, primary field, and also some of its descendants. So the conclusion from that, let me see, I need to read the conclusion. First is that exact diagonalization, this idea of just build a full Hamiltonian metric and diagonalize it, that's already pretty powerful. It allowed us to extract some of the universal information at the critical point. Okay? So that means we started from a microscopic Hamiltonian, and we were able to extract information about the collective behavior of our system. Okay? Just we start with a microscopic description. These are spins. They interact with this Hamiltonian. And through that diagonalization, we understood how actually a very large system, not just n equal to 10 sides, but n in the limit of an infinite number of sides, would behave. That would be the CFT. Okay. Okay. So the conclusion is that exact diagonalization is useful. On the other hand, we already saw that instead of getting the results exactly where expected, instead of getting, say, this point here, this point was a bit higher up, also this one, maybe this one was lower, and so on. Okay? And that was due to the fact that there were finite size effects. So the relation between the numerical data and the universal data is not so simple. It comes with corrections. And these corrections are important when the number of spins, n, is small. So what we saw is that if we actually wanted to improve the quality of the result, we had to go to larger number of spins. We had to consider larger spin chain. So what we did yesterday, Monday and Tuesday, was to work with a number of spins, which was on the order of 10. Okay? Now, that's good. We already started to see the emergence of this universal structure that characterizes the CFT. But actually, that happened there because I've chosen the Ising model, which is a very special model where for n equal to 10, you can already see something. Right? This was a result of heavy pre-selection of the problem we were analyzing. For a generic critical Hamiltonian, for n spin, for n equal to 10 spins, you're not going to see yet anything nice. So in general, we would like to, and the reason is these contributions here scale as 1 over n squared, but they can come with a very large prefactor and dominate the small n results. So if I had not specially selected the Ising model, we would not have been able to see that unless we could go to much larger n. So n maybe 100. It really depends on the model, but you really need to go much larger than 10 generically. And so how are we going to do this? Well, we just cannot, in principle. Remember that the cost, we were building very large objects, and the cost was roughly exponential, or was growing exponentially in n. And that means we cannot reach very large values of n. Very good. So today, what I want to do, are there questions about this? Yeah?
When you say universal, do you mean that it applies for all n, or does it mean something else?
By universal, I mean that you can consider the Ising model at criticality, or you could consider some other theory also at criticality. It turns out that many different critical theories behave as at criticality. They behave in a way that is described by the same conformal field theory, which is the universality class in this case of the Ising model. We're going to use directly the Ising model to put the label on the universality class of the phase transition.
But different models also give you that same
thing. Different models could give you exactly the same critical behavior, or another one that would be another universality class. Say there is another one called the three-level Potts model universality class, okay. Or another one called the tri-criticalizing model. So there are different universality classes.
Does each universality class have a different set of equations that relate the universal parameters and the numerical parameters?
The equations are the same. What's going to be different are these parameters. Okay. Right? So we would use the same axis, and then for another universality class, we would find that we have to put the dots somewhere else.
And the coefficients A and B, do they change between the different?
Right. So A and B are non-universal, not universal. The only thing that is universal about this expression are these guys, the scaling dimensions and the conformal spins, and also the central charge, C. The rest is non-universal.
So within one universality class, you can have different parameters, A and B?
Yes. Okay. So the idea is that we were, in this particular case, the Ising model, we were able to extract universal data, but that's not going to be so simple. For n equal to 10, we don't expect that to be possible in general. We would like to go to larger n. Okay, so today I'm not going to tell you how to go to n equal to 100, but I'm going to tell you how to go to n equal to 20, 30, okay? And that's it. All right, so let's get started. That's going to be 4.2. And I want to talk about computational cost. Very good. So when we talk about the computational cost, we want to look at two aspects. So given a problem of size m, and for instance, that's going to be how many components a vector has. We'll see it in a second. We would like to answer two questions. How much space, and this is memory, is required, and also how much time is this going to take? Okay? How much space, how much memory, how much time? And as a function of m, so what we want to ask is this scaling linear in m, or is it maybe quadratic in m, or is it exponential in m? Okay? That's the type of things that we would like to answer. So let me give you three examples that are going to be useful. So examples. First, I want to consider a vector-vector multiplication. So in this case, what I want to do is say I want to take some vector. I'm going to compute the scalar product of two vectors, and that's nothing but adding the products of individual components. Okay, so I'm thinking here that they have an index alpha that runs from 1 to some value m. So m, the size of the problem, right now is how many components my vector has. I have two of these vectors. I want to multiply them, and I want to characterize how much time this can take and how much space or memory it's going to take. Okay. Now, I want you to help me here. So if I look at this, okay, I'm going to have to do some small operations. And I don't care how much time this takes. I want to know how this scales with m. Okay. So for instance, here, what I have to do is I have to do something, take this element, V0 star or V1 star, take another element W1, right? Multiply them. I don't know how much this is going to take, maybe a second, maybe a millisecond. It depends on your computer. But the point is that I have to do this m times, OK? And then add all these numbers together, also m times, or m addition. So m multiplications followed by m addition. So how is going to be the scale? How does time scale with m? Question for you.
Linearly.
Okay, so that's going to be order m. Now, let's talk about space. So space is how large are these objects that we have to store, right? And everything here scales again as m, right? The initial vectors are order m. Final vector, well, the final vector is a number. So this is just order 1. But the largest objects that we have to deal with in this operation are the original vectors, and that storing them takes order m. Okay, so if I'm asked how much is the cost of vector-vector multiplication, I could start wondering what's the factors in front of m, but I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to say it's time is m, space is m. Okay, I hope this example is clear because I want you to work through two more examples. So the second one is going to be matrix vector multiplication. And obviously, I'm not talking about this in abstract. I want to use that to characterize the cost of what we've done and what we're going to do also later on today. So vector matrix vector multiplication. Okay. This time, what we have is so we have some final vector which is equal to multiplying some matrix times some other vector. Okay. And here, once more, alpha and beta run from 1 to m. Okay. And I would like you to tell me how much the time is going to be and how much the space is going to be this time. Okay. And maybe it's not so important the final result, but how you derive it. So we have to do something m times, right? Yep.
We do the same as in a vector-vector multiplication, but m times. So we'll have m squared for time.
Order m squared for time and space. The answer is yes, m squared. Space?
I would say same m squared.
And who is the biggest object we're dealing with that takes this space? It's the original metric, right? Okay, so what we have, very good. So that's the answer is correct. So this object here is the biggest one, okay? And that determines the space. And if you want to think about the time, you could think that for every value of alpha, okay, m of a fixed alpha, say alpha is equal to 1, okay, of beta, v beta, sum over beta, it is nothing but a vector, you know, this. If you take a matrix and you fix one of the indices, you get a vector, right? So this is nothing but a vector multiplication. We saw that the cos was scaling with m. And now we have to do this for each value of alpha, which will give you another factor m. Okay?
So for the space complexity, we're counting our original objects?
We are also counting, yeah, because you will have to do, you know, you'll need that memory at least to store those objects.
It depends what, here the original object is the biggest. So if your output was bigger, then you would take the dimensions of
it. Outrageous, huh? Are you unhappy with that?
Well, I mean, computer scientists do this kind of stuff all the time, and they never count that in your space complexity. So
well, you definitely need to store that somewhere.
Yeah, you need to store that somewhere, but we're talking about the space and time complexity of an algorithm, and that algorithm doesn't create a matrix or create.
It doesn't create it, but it needs to use it. It needs to refer to it.
So, that's time complexity. It just digs in your memory. It doesn't actually create extra.
No,
it doesn't allocate
right.
Okay. Your memory.
So what I want to know is if I'm going to be doing this in my computer,
yeah.
How much memory do I need?
Yeah, so you're just not interested in just the algorithm, but also in what the algorithm needs.
I'm interested in the problem. The problem is some input, is some output. I'm interested in how I solve it, obviously, but I still need to store the input somewhere. So, but okay, I've been told that debate is important, so I should let you discuss it. But I don't want to fight over a definition. Okay, I hope that what I've said is clear,
which is
it the algorithm or is it you know specifying the problem that I'm trying to solve? Bro, I don't care, right? I'm gonna count as. I want to characterize the time and space that goes into trying to address this problem, right? And that's the answer. Okay? Very good. Excellent. So finally, C, I want to deal with matrix-matrix multiplication. Okay? And now, so I'm going to write it like this. We want to multiply two matrices, then the result is another matrix. Uh, And now I'm going to assume that all these indices, alpha, beta, and gamma, are running from 1 to m again. And so I would like to ask you, again, how much is the time, how much is the space? OK? For those who are managed to move on from the previous question. So how is this going to how is this going to work?
So for time would be m times the product of a matrix and a vector. So m3.
Because for each value of alpha and gamma, we're just doing the same thing that we did at the beginning, the vector-vector multiplication. But now, so vector-vector multiplication gives us a factor m, and now we have to do it m times for alpha times m times for gamma, right? So that's m cubed, that's right? And memory, what's the largest object we're dealing with?
Still matrices, so m squared still.
It's still m squared. There is no need to build any other object here. Okay? And I'm not stating that this is the optimal solution. I'm saying this is how we would do it if we would add in this way, right? This is a way of doing this, obtaining this final result. There might be strange ways where there is some trade-off between space and time. Maybe we can increase space and then reduce time and so on. But here, the straightforward way of doing that, which is for each value of alpha, for each value of gamma, you add, you make m products of components and add them together. That's going to give us this m cubed, and space is going to be m squared. Very good. So we're ready to start investigating how to do better, how to lower the cost. If, for instance, we just care about the ground state of our Hamiltonian, how can we find it without having to build the whole Hamiltonian, or sorry, without having to go to matrix-matrix? Well, let me first describe a method, and then I'll tell you how it relates to what we've been doing. So I'm going to talk about power method. So here we have a Hamiltonian. And let me express it in terms of some set of directly in its in terms of its eigenvectors, E alpha, and energy is E alpha squared. And I'm going to assume that the ground state energy has larger absolute value than the first excited state. And so these energies has been ordered. I want you to think of this as, I'm going to plot here the energies. We have zero somewhere here, and we somehow have shifted all the spectrum to ensure that the ground state energy is some negative value, E0, that has the largest absolute value. And so this is m minus 1. Okay. So I don't know what happens in between, but I've shifted all the spectrum. And I made sure that E0, is the, which is the ground state energy. So let me write this, ground state energy. Is the eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian with largest absolute value. OK? Very good. And notice also here, I'm assuming that there is a finite gap. Okay? The first excited state has an energy which is a bit larger than the ground state. It's not, we don't have degeneracy there. Very good. So then let's write some arbitrary state. We can always expand it in this basis, in the eigen basis of the Hamiltonian. And now what I would like to study is what happens when we multiply this state by the Hamiltonian. Okay. The power method is a method that is based on multiplying many, many times some state by the Hamiltonian. I want to understand why this is interesting. So first thing is, if I multiply this initial state by the Hamiltonian ones, I can write the result is nothing but a new state, which when I expand in terms of the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, has new coefficients, which are the old ones multiplied by the energies. Okay? That's just to take h times psi. I have here, you know, this is already diagonal in this basis, so I just get to multiply the coefficients. And now let me do this not once, but p times. So now I want to multiply the state by the Hamiltonian p times. And so you can see that in this case, what we have is just a new state, which can be expressed as a linear combination of the energy eigenstates. This is just an orthonormal basis. And the coefficients now are the original coefficient of psi, but with energy to the p, power p. Okay. And now what I want to do is, I want to have a closer look at this state. I can get a factor of the energy, the ground state energy, to the p power outside, and write explicitly the rest of terms. And we get a term for the ground state. Then we get E0 over, this is wrong, this is O1 over E0, P, C1, okay? I didn't do anything, I just expanded this, but I took the ground state energy to the P power as a common factor in front, and so I have to divide, and so on. So for instance, E2 over E0 to the power P, C2, E2, and so on, okay? And now I want to point out that since we ask so let's look at E1 over E0, okay? The absolute value of this is smaller than 1 because we wanted E0 to be the guy with largest absolute value, right? That's what we demanded at the beginning. So if you have something that has absolute value smaller than 1, then that means that E1 to the E0 to power p, okay? Well, if this was smaller than 1, then you take the power p of that, and it's going to become much, much smaller than 1, right? It's exponentially suppressed in p. So the conclusion is that what we get here is E0 to the p power, and then the ground state plus order something that is exponentially suppressed in p. I'm just writing it this way. Okay. So basically, if we keep hitting an initial state with a Hamiltonian many, many times, what we're doing is we're converging exponentially fast towards the ground state. Are there questions? This is going to be a method that we're going to use now. If we just want the ground state, instead of diagonalizing the Hamiltonian, what we can do is we can start with some initial state and start multiplying it by the Hamiltonian. Okay. Why is this interesting? Well, we just saw that matrix vector multiplication is cheaper than matrix-matrix multiplication. And it turns out that diagonalizing the Hamiltonian is based on matrix-matrix multiplication. Okay? So what we did so far was diagonalizing the Hamiltonian. That requires matrix-matrix multiplication. If we just care about, say, the ground state, it turns out that we don't need to go to matrix-matrix multiplication. We could do matrix vector multiplication, and that would be cheaper. OK? Question?
Yes. So to apply this method, you need to move all this spectrum. And for that, you need to know the ground state.
Sorry,
what's that? So to apply this method, you need to move the spectrum. So
that you need to move the spectrum?
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, we'll have to find a way of making sure that all the spectrum is.
Basically, as a matter of fact, this is an overkill. All we need really is that the ground state
is has the largest absolute value, right? But we will able we will always be able to shift the spectrum in this way. We'll use some tree.
So you don't need to know the ground state before time to get the
ground. No. So we'll see it later. We'll see this later. But if you have the Dirac Hamiltonian is made of sum of local terms, and you have a way of shifting each local term enough to ensure that each local term can only contribute negative energies, then the sum will only be negative. So we'll see that. But there is a way of ensuring this property without solving the Hamiltonian. Yep.
You don't want to shift too much, right? Because like the more you shift, the smaller, like the closer to one that ratio will be. Like,
right.
The difference
right.
stays the same.
Okay. So the idea. That's a good point. But the idea is that the gap, you know, so what we will be able to do is to shift this in a way that we're shifting only order n. So if there are n sides, we'll shift by order n only. And that because the difference between the smallest energy and the largest energy is also only order n. Okay? So you can argue that, and then we'll see that indeed, if we had to shift this a lot exponentially, for instance, that could be a problem. But it happens that order n is enough. We don't have to do a lot of shift. So this will still be nice. Yeah, some. Small, sufficiently small, smaller than one, that things converge fast.
So using this method, we have to assume that p will be less than order m for it to be better than the matrix v.
Right. We'll have to do something like that. But OK, so let me write a table where we will make the comparison more explicitly, and then we can discuss. Any other question?
You're going to shift it by order n, which means that that ratio is going to be 1 minus something order 1 over n.
OK, let me write this table first, and then we can discuss. So I want to move to 4.4. I want to talk about exact diagonalization. Of H, of the Hamiltonian. And I want to talk about methods. So we're going to talk about methods, several of them. And then there will be some function, Julia function that we'll use. And we'll look at what's based on. And then we want to talk about the computational cost, and specifically, we want to see how time scales and how space scales. Okay. And let me see if I've managed to do this. Okay, so the first method is going to be full diagonalization. And this is what you've been doing. So given H, what we do is we identify some diagonal matrix of eigenvalues and u such that H is equal to u d u daga. Okay, that's the method we've been using. And the function that we call was ake of H, right? And now is where I'm telling you that this is based on matrix multiplication. You can go and see what algorithms are being used by Julia. Julia is not actually doing this. It's calling some basic library. It's the same library used by C++ or Fortran or any other programming language. And it all boils down to matrix multiplication. And then, so what do we know about matrix multiplication? We already mentioned that the time was m to the third power for an m times m matrix. But now here, what I want to also mention is that our m, the size of our vector space, is 2 to the n. Right? So m3 means 2 to the 3n. we said that the space was m squared. That's the size of these matrices we've been building. And that's nothing but 2 to the 2n. Okay? Remember, this is size dimension of the vector space of the n spins. Okay? So what we've been doing so far had scaling in time, which was exponential in the system size, in space, which was also exponential in the system size. And we're not going to be able to change that. But we can make it, you know, exponential with nicer scaling. Yeah?
Does I exploit the hermeticity of H?
Our hermeticity is not going to save us. I mean, it's not going to. It will change a little bit, the prefactor, but not in a significant way. Maybe we get another 2 or 4 of speed up. But it's not, that doesn't, well, yeah, order 2 or 4. So this is, well, it's, the matrix is real or complex Hermitian or just complex. There are different so the complexity increases a little bit as you consider more complex matrices.
And parallelism also change the algorithm.
Sorry?
What about parallelism change the algorithm?
Right. So there is some trade-off that you can start playing there. If you have, you may be able to use different algorithms, but I'm just sticking to the matrix-matrix multiplication-based diagonalization. Okay. So, well, I'm not so tall. So the next one, so the next one is sparse diagonalization. Okay, we want to improve on that. We want to have ways of finding, say, the ground state or ground state and low energy states, which does not go to that cost. Okay, so what we are going to do is we're going to be hitting some initial state with a Hamiltonian many, many times. Because we've said, we've seen, we've argued that this converges to the ground state. And this method, this method is called power method. And then it turns out that there are more sophisticated versions of it, which are still based on multiplying initial states by Hamiltonian. So there are more sophisticated versions that are called which is called Langsdorff's method. And based on the same ideas, they allow you to get not just the ground state, but also, say, the first 10 excited states. So how do we call this in Julia? Well, the function is called AIC-S, AIC sparse of H. And this time, we need to specify how many states we want. So the result will be a list of energies with the corresponding eigenvectors. And then we have two versions of it, okay? One version, so let me see how I can do this. I'm gonna draw this line here. And now I'm going to say that there are two versions of this. So the first version is based on matrix vector multiplication. In an obvious way, we're multiplying a vector times a matrix. And what we know, what we discussed before, still somewhere up there, is that the time scales as m squared, and the space scales as the size of the matrix, m squared. And therefore, we have been able to already reduce significantly the time that this will take. Okay. So in the next lecture, which follows this one, we'll move to the Psi room. And we'll understand, well, we'll try this, the power method to get the ground state. There is some other factor here which depends on how many states you ask for. I'm just not writing that. So assume that we just want the ground state, or n is equal to 1 or 2 or 3. So for a fixed number, the scaling in n is this. Yes? We're good?
But you need b of delta,
right? Right. So there will be some number of iterations that you have to apply, which
and
is...
And you still didn't argue why b is not order m.
Right. So let's not analyze that here. Did you see my strategy? First I said, I'll do it later, and now I say I won't do it. So I'm interested in the case where I want to understand how things scale with n, and to first order, that's how.
Wait, yeah, okay, but the scaling there, you only subtract something order n, and there you... So there you're going to have to do iterations of order n, not m.
You may have to do order n iterations, that would be fine. If I need to modify this with a factor n in front, that should work.
But the scaling is exponential in p, so like you should expect it to be quicker than, unless it's a really tiny measure.
P should be of the order of the difference between that ratio and 1, no?
Right, so suppose that stays. Okay, there are lots of things I need to explain. Is it okay if we keep going? And then I promise I'll discuss this with you. Okay, very good. So that's what we could do, and that would be already great. And there is one thing that we can do even better, which is I'm going to call sparse vector update. Okay. And it's based on the fact that our Hamiltonian, we have been talking about the Hamiltonian as if it was some matrix, but we haven't exploited the fact that it has some structure. It's a local Hamiltonian. The problems we're interested in are ground states of local Hamiltonians. Okay. So this Hamiltonian breaks into small pieces in a very particular way. Say its nearest neighbor. Right? That's what we had for the Ising model. And it turns out that exploiting this, the important thing is we never need to build H, which is this 2 to the n times 2 to the n matrix. Okay. We will find a way of not having to build this big metric, and yet understanding how to update a state when, so we'll be able to start with some state and multiply it by h, but without building h. Okay? So we'll see this actually in a few minutes. And in this case, it will turn out that the cost now is going to be to first order 2 to the n. Okay, we'll just have this vector, and we'll have to update 2 to the n components, and that's going to roughly be the cost of this form. We'll see that there is some factor n in front, okay? But that's linear, that's exponential. This is the important piece. And space is going to be, again, m. So let me just say it's m. We'll modify this a little bit later. And so the space is also going to be 2 to the n, okay? So now we're in business because we went from 2 to the 3n to 2 to the 2n, now 2 to the n. Okay? The bottleneck was always time. And what that means in practice is that here we managed to go, say, to n equal to 10 spins with this cost. Okay? If we reduce the cost from 2 to the 3n to 2 to the 2n, that may allow us to go, to consider n on the order of maybe 15 spins. And finally, here, we may be able to go, I think I'm doing something wrong. I'm going to say 20, and n is going to be on the order of 10 at 30 spins. Let me see if this makes sense. So 30, 20, yeah, I need to revert back to 15, probably. Sorry, guys. How is the math here? So if I look at time, right? 3n, 2n, 15, and that would be 30. Yeah, I guess that's what I want to say. But what's important is that we'll be able to increase significantly in the number of spins, and that would allow us to lower the finite size corrections that we were saying. Okay? This, don't take these numbers too seriously. I'm just saying, roughly speaking, now before we hit the wall at, say, 10 spins, we couldn't go much larger, we'll be able to go a bit, yeah, factor maybe 3 of that. Okay? Good. So in the last 10 minutes, I want to give you a start telling you how this can be done. And then later on, we'll apply it. So to proceed, I need to introduce some graphical notation. That is very useful. So if I'm going to represent a number, maybe complex, I'm just going to be writing a circle. If you see a circle with one leg, that's going to be a vector. So this could be just a number z. In general, complex. This could be some vector. So this in this leg here corresponds to the index alpha. If we want to talk about a matrix, we can represent it diagrammatically as a circle with two legs. So that could be m alpha beta. You see, the number of legs refers to the number of indices. And in general, I may want to talk about some tensor with n legs. And that's going to be a tensor. And an example would be psi alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha n, the components of a many body wave function. I want to, so I'm just going to be drawing things. And every time you see, say, a circle with two legs, you think, oh, that's a matrix. Okay? So let's have a look at those vector-vector multiplication and vector matrix and matrix-matrix multiplications. We could represent them in this way. Right, that would be vector-vector multiplication, where this is V dag and this is W. And you see the result is a number, right? So you see that on the left-hand side, there are no open legs. On the right-hand side, there are no open legs. So that should be a number. And that's the result of this multiplication. Very good. So a vector matrix multiplication, let me draw it this way, could be written in this way, okay? Where, let me follow the same notation. So this would be M. This would be V. This is V. This is the result vector. Okay? And again, quick look. If you look at here, how many open legs we have. We have conservation law for open legs. There is one here, so there is one there. Okay? Matrix-matrix multiplication. Would look like this. Okay? Is that clear? Because I'm going to be using this quite a bit from now on. Okay, so with this notation, then I want to discuss briefly what's this sparse vector update that I refer to in here. So we want to take psi and build psi prime, which is going to be h times psi, without ever building h explicitly as a 2 to the n times 2 to the n metric. So I'm going to be representing psi will be represented by tensor with n legs, okay? That's nothing but saying that psi is in some basis, local basis, this could be 0 and 1 of, I'm taking a basis of the Hilbert space. We have n spins. So I'm taking a product basis. So here, these alphas, so alpha I is taking two values, 0 or 1. And so what I'm taking as a basis is all the spins are, let's call 0 up, so all the spins are up. All the spins are up except the last one. All the spins are up except for this one. And so on. Okay? We have 2 to the n option here. It's a product basis for the full Hilbert space. I can represent any wave function in terms of this basis, and then the coefficients form naturally a tensor with n indices. And so that's what I'm representing here. Okay? And now what I want to argue is that, well, I'm going to draw for something, which is psi prime will be, remember that h is sum of local terms. So I can think of psi prime as take psi. I'm going to choose just 5 sites, and then I can do it explicitly. We multiply it by 1 Hamiltonian term plus multiplied by another Hamiltonian term. I'll explain what that means in a second in more detail. Another term. One more time. And finally, so what I've done is I've explicitly drawn diagrams that represent multiplying the initial state by every single Hamiltonian term. Okay? Remember, the Hamiltonian is a sum of local terms. The first term is acting on the first and second spin. And so that's going to be this guy. Okay? That's H1, 2, Hamiltonian term acting on spin 1 and 2. This is H23 acting on second and third spin. H34. H445. And this guy is H51 or 15. Doesn't matter. Okay? So the idea then is that indeed I can produce the result of multiplying H times psi. Okay, I can produce it by producing first these vectors, which are the result of multiplying psi times a term, Hamiltonian term, and this one, and this one, and this one. So we have 5 different vectors we need to build, and then we have to add them together. Okay? But the point is that at no stage I had to build the full 2 to the n times 2 to the n Hamiltonian metric. Okay? So let's then try to understand how expensive it is to multiply one of these terms together, how to multiply psi times, say, h1, 2. And then we'll see that we have to do this n times. Okay? And that will tell us how expensive it is to multiply psi times h without ever building h as a big met. Is the strategy clear? Is it clear what we're trying to do? Are these drawings okay? Or if you are not used to this, maybe it's a bit confusing. Yeah, question?
No, I don't understand what small h is.
Sorry?
Small h.
Yeah, very good. So remember in the Isaac Hamiltonian, we had sigma x m plus 1. And we had a sum over m. And then we had something like, maybe, I'm going to write it like this, minus this, minus And I'm going to write it also like that, mz plus z m plus 1 divided by 2. I'm going to put, I just rewrote the Hamiltonian that we've been studying as a sum over m of some object that depends, that only acts non-trivially on sides m and m plus 1. This thing here are operators acting on sides m and m plus 1. So this H12 is would be sigma x1, sigma x2, plus sigma z1, plus sigma z2, something like that. So the idea is that in the previous discussions, we were building a big matrix. And now, instead of doing that, we're going to exploit that the Hamiltonians we are interested in are local, are sum of local terms. OK, so what I want to discuss now is how to make this this particular manipulation here. Okay. So what we're going to do, before I do that, I want to go back to characterizing the cost. So we're going to talk about multiplying two matrices again, but I'm going to introduce a twist. So imagine that we have two matrices. So we want to make this matrix multiplication. But now this index alpha goes from 1 to m1, so it runs over m1 values. This index beta runs from 1 to m2 values. And this index gamma, so this is runs from 1 to m3. Okay. So instead of being square matrices, they are rectangular matrices. This matrix here is m1 times m2 dimensional. And this one is m2 times m3 dimensional. We're multiplying two rectangular matrices. We can always do that. The only thing that we want is that this dimension, the second dimension of the first matrix, is equals the first dimension of the second. OK, so this is going to give us something that has indices alpha and gamma. So let's write this again. C alpha gamma is equal to sum beta of A alpha beta B beta gamma. And now I want to ask you, what's the time, how much time this takes, and what's the space? Okay. So what's the time for this? How does the time scale in terms of as a function of m1, m2, and m3? And the answer has to be compatible with the answer we had before, which is when m1 is equal to m2 equal to m3, we got m cubed, right? So whatever it is that we, the new answer should reduce to the old answer for in the case where all the m's are the same. So what is it going to be?
I mean, you calculate m1 times m3 numbers, and each calculation takes m multiplications, m2 multiplications, and m2 sums.
Okay.
So it's just the product of the three.
M1 times m2 times m3. Very good. That's the answer. Okay. So if we want to multiply two rectangular matrices, all we need to do, we can go back to this drawing and say, okay, let me look at how large this is, how large this is, how large this is, and just take the product of the sizes of the index. Okay. No surprise here, right? I mean, that's compatible with what we've seen. And in the end, it's what Nick just said, that you know, if you fix alpha and gamma, you have a vector-vector multiplication that will cost you m2. And now you have to do this for all values of alpha, which are m1, and all values of gamma, which are m3. OK? Very good. Is that clear? But at least it's reasonable, right? And then you can think about it for a minute. So what I want to think, what I want to do now is I want to take the first diagram. And I want where this is psi and this is H12. And I'm going to convert that, this multiplication, into a matrix-matrix multiplication. Okay? What I'm going to do is I'm going to put together these indices. So and these indices and also these indices. And I'm going to regard this has some form of matrix-matrix multiplication, where this is a matrix of dimension. Let me see what I want to, how I want to organize this. So here we have M1 is going to be four-dimensional because, well, just think about this, right? Each index here was taking two values. So if you have two of these indices, you run over four different values. So M1 was four, takes four, yeah, M1. The first index alpha runs from 1 to 4, which is 2 squared. The second index beta runs through m2 values, which is again 4, which is 2 squared. And the last index gamma runs through m3 values, which in this case is 8, which is 2 to the 3, which is nothing but 2 to the n minus 2 in general. If we had n sites, what we're doing is, you know, let me draw it for n sites. So imagine we have many, many sites, and we put just one term here. So now we're going to have to put n minus 2 indices together. Okay. So it's going to be 2, 2, and n minus 2 always. Okay. So the cost of multiply after reshaping these things, and we're going to assume that that cost doesn't dominate. The bottom layer happens to be this multiplication. Okay? And this multiplication has cost m1 times m2 times m3, which in this case is 2 to the 2 times 2 to the 2, 2 to the n minus 2. And that's always 2 to the n plus 2, okay, for any n. And that's where you see that in order to get this piece here, just this piece, the cost is 2 to the n. Okay? And now what we need to do is we need to do this multiplication, but also this multiplication, and so on. Okay? We need to do n of those. And so the cost is going to be order n 2 to the n. I'm going to write the 2 here, but that's not important. Okay? The cost of updating this state to account for multiplication by the Hamiltonian scales now as 2 to the n and maybe times n. Okay? All right. So I ran out of time, but that's also just what I wanted to tell you. So if maybe we can take a break, and if there are questions, we continue in 10 minutes in the other room.